Hello, thank you for joining me on Tactical Startup. This week, we're going to be talking with Brooke Lively. She is the CEO and founder of Cathedral Capital, a team of CFOs and profitability strategists who help entrepreneurs turn their businesses into profitable companies. After earning her MBA in investments and corporate finance, Brooke built a seven-figure company in under 2 years. As a chartered financial analyst, CFA, she and her team work with Hall of Famers, Inc. 500 businesses, CEOs, and small business owners with expertise in growth and management, creative problem solving, and profitability strategy. Brooke has been named Top 25 Women to Watch, 2016-2020 Diversity Journal, Woman Worth Watching, and Fort Worth's 2016 CFOs of the Year. She's a highly regarded international speaker and the author of several books, including an international bestseller. Brooke has been featured in international media, including CNBC, Forbes, U.S. News and World Report, Fort Worth Business Press, and Authority Magazine. So I'm very excited to have Brooke on here, and let's get started, shall we? You're listening to Tactical Startup, a podcast dedicated to building amazing businesses. I'm your host, Taylor Darcy. In this podcast, we explore ways to innovate, improve, and level up your business through sales, marketing, automation, and business planning. Successful businesses pivot when times are bad and stay the course when times are good. We will have guests from different walks of life to help you see that success is not only possible, but even probable, no matter when or where you start. Through hard work and strategic planning, you can have the entrepreneurial life you've always dreamed. Tune in weekly to level up your business. Hello, Brooke. Welcome.
Hi, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm very excited to have you on. One of the things I like to do with my podcast is talk about ways that people can make better choices, because at the end of the day, that's really what we are, right? And so I wanted to have you on because of your breadth of knowledge and depth of knowledge. And certainly as a CFA, that is crazy impressive. I looked into getting my CFA, and I didn't even make it to starting the application because of the of how difficult it looked. And as much school as I've been into, I just couldn't take any more time to do that. So,
Well, my brother suggested I go back to law school. I'm like, I will never take another standardized licensing test again. So bars out, I'm not doing it.
I don't blame you one bit. The bar is insane. I don't recommend it. It's not my idea of a good time. So one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show was because a lot of entrepreneurs, they worry about the money later, right? Their sole focus is getting people in the door, and they don't budget, they don't plan. And so what I wanted to do is talk with you and help people see the benefits of planning rather than just kind of flying by the seat of their pants. So kind of share with us what it is that you start with. How do you begin the process?
Wow, that is kind of the ultimate of an open-ended question there. I guess where it starts is most people start a business because they're passionate about a product or a service. And so they start this business, and all of a sudden they get into it and they realize that the business, that the financial is a big part of it. And what really frustrates me more than anything else is people devoting so much time and so much energy to a business that doesn't make money, that does not give them enough money to live the life they want to live. I mean, that's why we started a business, right?
Right, right.
So that we have that freedom and that autonomy and that control. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you don't have that. So, right. You know, I think the biggest thing that we look at is profit. How much is your profit, and right. How much are you as the owner taking in total owner compensation?
So have you, do you prescribe, there's lots of of theories out there as far as, you know, how, like, profit first. And that was the one I was getting at.
Yep.
Is that a particular one that you recommend or to start with, or what's like, if you're getting down to the, like, the brass tacks, like, where do you begin with an entrepreneur when you sit down, or a startup business owner, and you sit down, okay, so now you've decided you actually want to work on your money rather than just kind of hoping for the best. Where do you start? What's your first thing that you do?
So, by the way, you talked about profit first, and we love profit first. Mike Michalowicz actually wrote a quote for my books. So, yes. Yeah. So I'm a big believer, and I'm a big fan of Mike M, as we call him. I think the most important place to start is with your cash. Find your true cash balance, which is not, by the way, what that handy dandy little app on your phone says it is. Your cash balance is actually the amount of money that your bookkeeping system says you have. So whether it's QuickBooks or Zoho or, you know, all the other options, people forget about float. I got in a call from a company. It was actually an oil and gas company. They were doing about between, I think, $6 or $7 million a year in revenue. They had 40 some odd employees, I think, and they didn't know how much cash they had. So they would pull up the app every time they had to write a check, and they would go walking through the office asking the other partners, have you written a check that hadn't cleared yet? Trying to figure it out. And I'm like, guys, we got to get you some software. You right. all need to do this. And they were right. like, oh my God, it's a revelation. We actually know how much money we have now. And I said, okay, well, now that we've gotten that very baseline,
right.
really the first place we start is your cash flow forecast.
Right.
Being able to look out 6 to 8 weeks and know how much cash you're going to have at the end of every week. That gives you confidence. It helps you run your business, and it gives you time. If you're going to run out of money in 5 weeks, you can do something about that.
Right,
you can
right.
shift a bill. You can, you know, draw down on your line of credit. There's all kinds of stuff you can do.
Right.
If it's 5 days, there's not much you can do. If it's 5 hours, there's basically nothing you can do.
Right. Yeah. I think you talk about a very interesting point on that one. I think first step is to begin tracking things, right? Like at the end mm-hmm. of the day, if you're not tracking it, you don't even know where your money's going, that's a real problem to start with. I know a lot of entrepreneurs that I've worked with in the past, they don't know where their money's going. They just spend mm-hmm. without regard to any type of not just system, right? You know, they're going based, oh, my CPA told me that this was tax deductible. And you're like, okay, but that doesn't change the fact that you don't have money to pay your rent later or whatever it may be.
Right.
So, you know, there's that starting point.
Absolutely. And can we talk about the myth of tax deductibility?
Sure, absolutely. Anything.
All right. Here's the thing. People are like, oh yeah, I went ahead and bought that because I didn't want to have to pay tax. So at the end of the year, I wanted to spend all the money so then I wouldn't have to pay tax. Okay, fair enough. You don't have to pay tax on it if you spend it. However, I would much rather have 60, 70% of something than 100% of nothing.
Right.
So I ran into someone, I was talking to a potential client one day, and he said, well, you know, my accountant wanted to save us in taxes. So every year for the past 10 years, we've been buying about $1 million piece of equipment. I'm like, okay. They're like, every December we kind of buy $1 million piece of equipment. I'm like, how's that working out for you? I'm like, is it productive? He was like, oh yeah, no, we never use it. We just did that so we wouldn't have to pay taxes.
What? Like,
yeah,
Yeah.
So they spent $10 million, $10 million to avoid paying tax, as opposed to paying $4 million in tax and having $6 million left over.
Wow. That's interesting. Cause I couldn't imagine advising someone to spend $1 million just for the sake of spending $1 million. Right. Like, I mean, to me, that just screams bad idea. Like, yeah, so you're not paying taxes and you're losing out on $6 million. One of the other things that, so I used, full disclosure, I used to do taxes for individuals and small mm-hmm. businesses. And one of the things that people would be like, oh, if I, you know, write off all of this income, I don't have to pay taxes on it, which is great. Except for then when they would try to go get a loan with their income to the IRS, you look like you make nothing. And to the bank, you look like you make nothing as well. And mm-hmm. so then you're like, well, I can't get a loan because I've made nothing. And they're like, mm-hmm. but I have income, right? So I can't get some additional capital if I need it, or I can't get a credit card if I, whatever it is, simply because yeah. they've deducted everything, which is what, you know, people say. So it's like, okay, so you're hurting yourself on two fronts, right? You're not only costing yourself that $6 million that should have, in that instance, where it should have been able to help build your business, not just sit there and do nothing. And then on the other side of it is you can't use that income that you've deducted for expenses on improving your business, like for loans or any type of that. And not all debt is bad debt, right? There are some people that have some interesting takes on debt, and you know, people that put anything in a blanket statement, are lazy, right? Because there are some forms of debt that are acceptable, and some that you want to stay away from. Can you share with my listeners like that idea, if I'm right?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that there is debt that we get into by accident. And I think there is debt that we take on for a particular reason to achieve a specific goal. So if you think about it personally, you know, you just kind of charge everything on your credit card, and then the bill comes, you don't pay it all off, but you keep charging because there's still like availability. Right. That's kind of like mindless debt.
Right.
You're not paying attention. You're just kind of spending money everywhere.
Right.
Saying, I am going to take I'm going to draw down $50,000 on my line of credit to do this particular ad campaign, which will generate $400,000 worth of revenue or $800,000 worth of revenue.
Right, right.
That is very specific, and that is a great use of debt. Absolutely.
I think that's a valid point, like the intentionality behind it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, are you doing it with the intent of building, or are you doing it with the intent of spending, right? Like that's a very yeah. big difference between the two.
And are you doing it in advance?
Right.
Or are you doing it to backfill something that you've already kind of screwed up?
Right.
Like, we're running a loss. I haven't been looking at our financials. Sales are down, but I haven't been cutting any expenses anywhere. So now we're running a loss every month. So let me keep drawing down on the line of credit.
Right.
No, let's cut the expenses. Let's be proactive instead of being reactive.
Right. Have you seen the new, there's a show out right now called We Crashed. Have you seen
it? No. Is it like fascinating entrepreneurs who crashed their businesses?
Well, it's about WeWork and Adam Newman and what he did with WeWork. And it's fascinating to listen. I don't know how accurate it is. I know that Adam Newman and that whole thing was a big, you know, craziness. But I didn't know the details of it. So I'm not sure if the show is accurate, but it's interesting because he talks about how he, you know, he goes into absurd, crazy long leases and crazy terms of his lease. And you're just sitting there going, like, as a business owner, you're like, this is a bad idea for everybody. You just have to. Yeah. And his mantra is spend your way out of debt. And like, you're shaking your head. You're like, look, I'm all for growth. I'm all for, you know, maximizing your income and maximizing your profitability. But at the end of the day, there's certain things that are unsustainable, and that's one of them, right? You can't spend your way out of debt because eventually it catches up to you, you end up in a Ponzi scheme, either one.
Well, yeah, that's true. But that goes right along with that one that, you know, I was in retail for a while, and we had the mantra, sales cures all.
Yeah.
And there's so many people that think that if I just sell more, it will all be okay. Here's the problem. If you're mispriced,
yeah,
the more you sell, the bigger the deeper the hole you're digging.
Right. It's so true. Yeah.
Sales can be awesome, or right. sales can be really, truly a curse.
Yeah. Well, and I think especially if, you know, you can only go so low, right? Like a sale is meant to, typically, in my experience, is meant to revitalize inventory, not as an actual, like, you know, you're trying to get stuff off your shelf that's costing, as opposed to...
I just meant like any sales. Oh, right. Like just go out and make, not put it on sale, but just go out and sell.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, I see what you're saying. I gotcha. Okay, perfect. Yeah.
So you want to know the most creative thing I ever learned about... Sure. So I'll run into people and I'll be like, we're not making money on this particular product. We need to raise the price. They're like, no. It's my loss leader. It pulls them in. I lose just a little bit of money on that, but they ultimately spend all this other stuff.
Right.
So Walmart, who has a gajillion people watching every nickel and every bottom line,
yeah,
went to, I guess it was Johnson & Johnson, and said, we can't carry Pampers anymore. We lose too much money on it.
Wow.
And Johnson & Johnson was like, no, you got to carry the Pampers. You right. have to have it. And they're like, so you either have to cut our price
right,
so that we can make some money on it, or we can't handle it more. And Johnson & Johnson said, just wait, give us a little bit of time. So they went back and they researched. And they looked at the way Walmart customers spent money, mm-hmm. whether they paid cash, check, or credit card. They looked at the way Walmart distributed their product. And Johnson & Johnson came back and said, okay, here's the deal. We're going to sell you the diapers at the same price. You're going to sell them at the same price. You're going to lose a little bit of money. However, we are going to sell you the diapers on 30-day terms. Mm. We're going to ship you diapers every single day.
Oh, wow.
We're going to give you 30-day terms, and you collect your money within 3 days from the client. So you can sit on that and make interest for 27 days. And that interest outweighed the loss on the diapers and made them a break even to slight profit item.
Wow.
Isn't that the coolest thing you've ever heard?
That is a good, that's creative. I like that. Cause I've heard other things about Walmart that like, yeah. they're kind of like the mafia when it comes to like pricing and stuff like that. They'll do that, but with other people, and they won't bend, or they won't say, hey, make do this. They'll just have to cut their prices. And it's a little scary when you're like, okay, is it cool that a company is doing that? And generally I would disagree, but I mean, I get you want to maximize your profit. Absolutely. That is, right. you know, that's a given. Like Costco does that with their chickens, right? That's their loss leader in Costco.
Yeah. And they're always way back of the store.
Exactly. And that's why they put like stores put milk in the back of the store, right? Because people go to the back to get the milk and they spend money on the way. Like you never go in and just get milk. And same thing with the chickens. Like the chickens cost them money, but they know that people are going to spend way more money if it's at the back of the store.
Right. But here's the thing. Mm-hmm. There are very few small businesses that have the buying power to overcome a loss leader.
Yeah, it's true.
There are very few small businesses that can negotiate with Johnson & Johnson in a way that will make Johnson & Johnson get that creative to keep the business.
Yeah.
So I am not a huge believer in loss leaders for small businesses, because they tend to just be losses.
Right. I mean, there could be some, I mean, I can think of like an ebook, right? Like if you're selling an ebook where it costs you X amount of dollars to do it, and I'm talking opportunity costs, not actual cost, because opportunity cost is different. But if you're talking about like, you know, you write an ebook and you're selling an ebook for $20, right? Like that to me, that gets people in the door, because I've known for, you know, because it's so cheap, nobody cares about losing $20. But the idea being, excuse me, that giving something, once someone buys from you, how easy is it for them to buy from you again? And I'll give you a really good point. Have you installed any game on your phone in the last 10 years? Candy Crush?
No, I've installed two games, neither of which I paid for, and no, I never do the upgrade.
Okay. So there's
I'm the anomaly, and I don't have children that are demanding to buy a game.
Okay. So what they do is, this is a brilliant idea. So the apps now have like all in-app pricing. For the most part, you don't buy an app anymore, right? You just buy you just buy something within the app. And what a lot of the apps will do is they'll get you on a $2.99 something or a 99-cent something. And once they break that in your head, like they make it so that it's so cheap that you can't say no. And then once you've done it once, then it's so much easier to keep doing it later. And that's why, like, there've been kids that have racked up hundreds and thousands of dollars worth of bills in their kids and their parents' accounts. Now they've greatly tamped down on it, Apple Store and whatnot. They've greatly reduced that to the point where you have to get parents' permission and blah blah blah. But it used to be like there have been stories of that where they would buy like Candy Crush points, and the parents got a bill for $300 or $400 because of it.
Oh my god!
And you're like, but it was because it was all 99 cents, and you're like, but it's only $1. It's a buck. Who can't afford a dollar, right? Like anybody that affords a phone can afford a dollar. And so the problem is that once you break that barrier in people's mind about spending something with you, it makes it so much easier to spend it later. So I totally get the loss leader idea, but I agree with you on the concept of, for most small businesses, it's going to hurt you more than it's going to help you, right? Because getting them in the door is part of it, but then it's going to cost you X amount, because I'm sure those chickens cost, right, you know, $10 or something stupid.
And right? Here's the thing with loss leaders. They only work at scale.
Yeah, it's true.
And makes sense. Most small businesses don't have the scale to be able to do that.
Right. So what would be your recommendation for, because you can only cut so much, right? Like there's a bottom level of expenses that you can cut to get to, right? To just to generate, to do your business, right? I mean, granted, I've talked and I've mentioned this on my podcast and my live videos before that, you know, you don't need a lot to get started. If you really want to do something, you can find a way to do it, whether it's writing it on a napkin. I mean, you know, there's a pen at the grocery store you can borrow for a period of time if you can't afford a pen, right? There's ways to get started without spending a lot of money. But once you've reached a certain point, and then as attorneys, I have basic needs, right? Like I have things that I need to purchase in order to grow, like especially when it comes to like just something basic like email, right? Because I need security on my email that you just don't get with freebie stuff. And so that costs money. But once you start eliminating expenses, what is the best way to maximize profit after that?
It's really all about your pricing and your people. So we believe in the rule of thirds.
Okay.
One third of your gross profit. So let's be really specific. If you're selling a product,
right?
So this is after cost of goods sold. If you're a service-based business, you really don't have cost of goods sold. So it's just your revenue.
Right.
One third goes to the people doing the work.
Okay.
One third goes to overhead. And one third should go to profit. So that relationship between the amount you're paying your people, and especially in service-based businesses, the amount at which you're selling their time.
Right.
So if you have an employee that you're paying $100,000 a year, we're going to use really easy math.
Right.
They should be billing and collecting between $300,000 and $500,000 a year. And it's that relationship, making sure that you've got their billable rate at a place where they have the ability to collect that their billable rate is at a place where they are able to work enough hours to do that. Your collection rate, your collection procedures are in place to be able to collect that money. But it's that relationship that really drives profit, especially in service-based businesses, but also in product-based businesses too. After that cost of goods sold, you've got to control that margin, that gross margin. And then from there, are you spending money where it's appropriate?
Right. So what are some expenses that you've seen that people spend money on besides the $1 million people that spend?
Yeah, I mean, that one's really?
Nuts. Yeah, that one's nuts.
It wins.
It does. It does. Because I can't imagine having, first of all, having $1 million to just blow like that. Like I wouldn't want to use that money for something else, right? Like I could do so much with that million. Or 600,000, right? Like that's really what we're talking about here. So if we're talking that, what could I do with $600,000 and bring on a new employee, bring on to do anything to improve productivity?
They didn't have to pay tax.
Oh yeah, I know. That's nuts. That just blows my mind. Like seriously, like I can't imagine spending that kind of money just for the sake of saving. I mean, I'm all for saving money, right? Like taxes, especially because no one wants to pay more taxes than they have to. Like you'd rather get something out of it.
Yeah, but you know what, Taylor?
That's absurd.
I love it when our clients pay giant tax bills. It makes me so stinking happy.
Okay.
Because it means they've made a shit ton of money.
Nice. Okay. I can get on board with that, right? Like I can get on board with that. That makes sense. Yeah. I guess, and I think if you frame it in that perspective, I think that's a valuable perspective, right? As opposed to the people that are struggling, they're not paying taxes. Sure, great, they're not paying taxes, but they're also spending $1 million on something that's worthless, or they're losing out on that 600,000 or 6 million over that time period that they're not. So,
or like you said, you were talking about, you know, running everything through your business, making, you know, everything's a deductible expense. I was at an EO meeting, entrepreneurs organization, and someone was standing up and he was telling this story. And it was about trying to get a mortgage. And he went to the mortgage broker and, you know, he's got this really successful business. And so he gave all the stuff to the mortgage broker and the mortgage broker called him back and said, "You don't pay any taxes, do you?" The guy's like, "No.
Isn't that great?
My accountant is so stinking awesome. And they like figure out how I don't pay any taxes." And the mortgage broker said, "Yeah, you're the poorest rich person I've ever met. And I can't give you a mortgage. Because on paper, you can't afford it."
Yep. So it looks like you either run the mortgage, like, yeah, how do you buy that then? And I dealt with that too.
The answer was no, you can't buy a new house.
Exactly.
And by the way, it's going to take 2 years of tax returns.
Yeah.
Because you got to have 2 years of good tax returns to solve that problem.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's true. And that was the obstacle that I ran into with when I worked. I worked in real estate loans and stuff like that. And we ran into that similar scenario, right?
Yeah.
And my parents were entrepreneurs as well. They were business owners and they would do the exact same thing. And every year it was like, so you're looking good. You're not paying taxes to the IRS, but you're also not getting the benefits of having that income.
Yeah.
You can't have it both ways. You can't not pay the taxes because you're, you know, deducting everything and then also using that as income, right? Because otherwise you're effectively zero. People use, pass through taxation because I work with a lot with LLCs and corporations, S corps and stuff like that. And pass through taxation is one of the benefits of those, but I'm not sure how well they use it, right? Like how appropriately they use it. They use it typically like that. So I wanted to dive a little bit more, like as far as what made you go on this journey. What prompted this? Because every entrepreneur that I've ever met, or every person that works with entrepreneurs, has a reason why they are what they are. Right? Like you became CEO and CFA and got your MBA in this, and you did it with an intent for some reason. Tell me about that reason. I'd love to hear it.
I think that a lot of people end up, I think for a lot of people, it's accidental. I had a plan when I was in high school and it was very specific and the plan got blown up and thrown out the window and lit on fire, the whole nine yards. Mm-hmm. And so I really kind of operated without a plan. And I went back to school at 30, I went back to grad school at 35 and got my MBA in, and I got a double MBA, corporate finance and investments. I started the CFA program. When you've got an investments MBA and a CFA, you go work for a hedge fund, right? I went and worked for a hedge fund. That's what you're supposed to do.
Yep.
And my father, who liked to shed his partners every 7 to 10 years, shed his partners, and for the first time in about 20 years, lost his office manager, practice manager, whatever you wanted to call it. And so he told me, he's like, I need you to help me start this new firm. Hedge fund was like, you're an analyst. We don't care if you're in Dallas, if you're in Fort Worth, we don't care where you are, just crunch the numbers. So I spent 2 days in Dallas, 3 days in Fort Worth at my father's office. And I set up his law firm and helped him grow it. And quit working at the hedge fund because I didn't actually love that, even though I was supposed to. Right. And was running my father's firm and ran it in a different way than most law firms get run. And I was working with a consultant, and his clients started coming to me and saying, can you do for us what you're doing for your family? And that was when I really realized that especially well-educated people like attorneys and doctors, people who have gone and gotten professional degrees, have so much knowledge about their, you know, about the law or about medical or whatever it is, but school doesn't teach them how to run a business. And so many of them were running their own businesses, and it was so hard. And I'm like, it shouldn't be so hard, and you shouldn't have to do it by yourself. And that's why I started this. It's to help those people overcome their lack of education, because I mean, Taylor, you've got better things to do than, you know, studying finance books.
Right.
You need to go out and practice law. You need to go out and do those things that you love doing and leave stuff like this to other people.
Full disclosure, I do have an MBA in finance as well.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
That's okay. No, I'm, in fact, I knew one of the things that, you know, and before I became an attorney, so my parents were carpet cleaners, and they did lots of entrepreneurial jobs. They did upholstery. They did lots of different things. My mom did Avon. I mean, there was just essential oils, you name it, they were doing stuff like
they,
that.
They tried it.
They've tried it. And I saw how they managed their business, and I basically became what I became for the very reason, same reason, essentially, that you did. And a lot of it, they floundered not because they didn't have a good product. Like, their product was excellent. Highly regarded, well, top-notch product, carpet cleaning. They just mismanaged it, right? They didn't know what they didn't know. And so what ended up happening was, so I went to law school because of my parents way back when had a contract that they had negotiated with a motel to clean their carpets. And it was such a crappy contract that my parents got taken advantage of because of it. And so, but along the way, I realized one of the big deficiencies in law is that people, they don't teach business in law. They teach how to practice law, not how to run a business. And so,
or how to pass the bar.
Right.
That's another thing they like to teach.
Yeah, school. They'll teach you how to pass the bar. They won't teach you how to practice sometimes.
Right.
I went to a law school where they did actually teach us how to practice, thankfully. So I didn't come That's out awesome. Going, what do I do now? But I realized that for the same reason that you did was that so many law firms, you know, they get to be partner not because they're good at managing, but because they're good at practicing law. And that's a problem because what ends up happening is that then they mismanage it, not because they're unintelligent. It's because that's not what they're good at, right? And sometimes the employees make the worst managers in the entire world because they are so good at being an employee that they're terrible at running a business. And it's not because they're terrible people. It's because they're terrible at running a business. There's a very big difference between being an employee and running a business. And so I got the MBA that very reason, because I realized that that would be somewhat of my competitive advantage, right? Like I'm not just looking at problems from a legal perspective. I can look at things from a business perspective as well and give clients like an insight into, okay, maybe this isn't a legal problem, or even if it is a legal problem, let's see if we can solve this without legal, let's solve it with the business thing and have a successful relationship, right? And build instead of just, okay, let's sue or, you know, that type of thing. And so that's a little bit more about my story. So we have very similar in that respect about how our parents and all that stuff and how we became. So that's neat.
But I do want to hit on something that you said, because I really do want people to hear it. Just because you don't have an education in business, just because you don't know how to run the financial side of your business, does not mean you are unintelligent.
Oh, no.
It does not mean you do not have the ability to do it. You just don't have the education. And frankly, it's probably not the best use of your time.
No.
Find people who have that skill set and hire them. Don't try to develop it yourself. And it's not that you can't. I mean, I could practice law. I'd be a fabulous lawyer.
Right.
I don't want to go back to law school and get that done. Right? So it's much easier for me to hire someone, usually my brother, to do it.
Right.
It's the exact same thing. And I think that so many people feel so much shame.
Yeah.
Like your parents got taken advantage of. Your parents tried all these different things. And it wasn't that they weren't good people, that they were unintelligent, that they mismanaged the business on purpose. It was just a skill set that they hadn't learned.
Right.
Right.
Well, and they were caught in this different mindset is really what it came down to. Like opportunity cost being what it is, right? Like when you think of it, if you're running a company, you should be running the company, right? That's why in larger companies, they have inside counsel. That's why they have CFOs. That's why they have these different positions, because that
they
CEO.
They have professional managers of those different things.
Exactly. And that's the differences, because if you're working so much in the business that you can't work on the business, and I know that gets said a lot, there's a lot of cliche around that. I'm not going to go into those details, but if you're working so much in the business that you can't work on the business and you can't like come up with goals and ways of achieving those goals, that's a bigger issue, right? Because you're never going to get ahead. You're always going to be catching up. And so, but it's also like, what would you rather be doing? You know, from my dad's perspective, he was a great carpet cleaner, and he was a great, he did the best spot dye you could imagine. And he did best red stain removal you could ever do. The problem is that when you get older, eventually you can't do that stuff anymore.
It's hard to crawl around on the floor and get that done.
It is. Yeah. Exactly.
And I think that, I think that the way the world has developed and the use of technology, there are professional managers out there.
Yeah.
And most small companies don't think about the fact that they can buy those on a fractional basis.
Yeah.
You don't have to have a full-time CFO. You can get a CFO for a very reasonable rate if you get a fractional one. You don't have to have a CMO, a chief marketing officer. You don't have to have somebody in-house doing your SEO or your pay-per-click or your social media. You can hire a fraction of a person. You can hire them for a few hours a day, a week, a month, and get that. So I think it is really take advantage of the technology and what it is enabling us to do to actually buy the expertise that you need.
Right. And look at it as an investment. That's one of the big things that I found, was a lot of them look at it as that's another expense I can't afford, right? Like they look at legal and they say, oh, that's just expensive. And one of the last contracts that I've helped negotiate, I saved him from making a $50,000 mistake.
Yeah.
And if that's a better return on investment. My fee was a better return on investment than the stock market. Okay. By a lot.
Absolutely.
And it's like, okay, so you pay me, and I'm just using a number. I'm not saying this is what I charged him. I can't say that, but like 10%, you pay me 10% of that, of what it was going to be. And I save you $45,000. Okay. So at that point you have to say, that's a dang good investment, Because what other investment can you basically 40 times your thing? And or 10, whatever number, you know what I mean? The point was, yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
But there's very rare, those are very rare things. And so people look at especially professional expenses as, oh, that's too expensive, right? Even at the base level, you know, they try to justify to rationalize it. But when you're talking about like with what you're doing and helping them maximize their profits through cash flow and being able to stay in business because they are managing cash flow, which as an entrepreneur and business owner myself, cash flow is the biggest pain in the world of what I have to deal with on a regular basis because of the infrequency. You know, I'll have months that just blow out of the water, and then I have months where I'm sucking air. And it is a real challenge. And so being able to say, okay, let's level out those peaks and those valleys so that we get a more consistent, more upward trajectory spend and cash flow is where you want to be. And I think that's valuable to them. Any other thoughts, wisdom, things that people that are starting or continuing that you think would be, like, what's your joie de vivre? What's your thing that said that you love to tell people because it helps them the most?
Get paid for what you do. I think that profit first. Mike Michalowicz took the basic P&L equation,
right?
Revenue minus expenses equals profit, and he turned it on its head and said revenue minus profit equals expenses. And you know, it's that old adage of pay yourself first.
Yeah.
You got to figure out how to do it in such a way that you get paid. And if you can't figure out a way for you to get paid the money you need to live or want to have,
right,
then this is not the business for you to have.
Right. Yeah. I think to add to that, I think like attorneys are notorious. Like there was a guy, I kid you not, that he had billed somewhere in the range of $150,000 for the year, which was, you know, not crazy, but you know, that's not a small number. He collected $25,000.
Oh God.
Because he wouldn't collect.
Yeah.
He if people didn't want to pay him, he just didn't go after. He didn't seek out ways to collect, right? Like, and in law, we have a very challenging, I'm not even going to go into that because it's not worth discussing, but so many people don't collect, right? Like they don't do the next steps to get their money. And I think so
I got to tell you, Taylor.
Yeah.
AR is created the first time you ever meet a client. Yeah. It is created in the sales call.
Yeah.
So it's not about collecting after it's due. It's about putting things in place when you first meet a client to collect as work is done or ahead of work being done.
Exactly.
So that if at any point they do stop paying and you don't get fully paid, what you're missing out on is profit, but you have covered all of your expenses. Sorry, it's a soapbox. I'll get off.
No, you're great. That's exactly like we call that in when we're doing contracts, we call that keeping ahead of the game, right? Like you set it up so that you get paid 60% of the job before you start. And then you start asking for money when you're at the 50% mark. So you've got 10% leeway and then keep that up throughout the project until it's paid off, right? Until it's paid in full.
The other big thing you should do is always take payment timing out of the client's hands. So I was visiting my best friend. She lives in Pennsylvania. We'd gone out to dinner. It was Sunday night. We come home. We're sitting at the kitchen table. She opens a drawer and pulls out like this stack of mail. She can barely get the drawer open.
Oh my.
She starts opening mail. She's got the trash can next to her. I'm like, Martha, what is that? And she's like, it's about 6 weeks worth of mail. I'm like, holy cow. Like, have you not paid any of your bills in 6 weeks? And let me tell you, incredibly successful.
Right.
Fortune 500 company, really, really like the second highest ranked woman, like really incredible. It wasn't that she couldn't pay the bills.
Right.
And she said, no, all my bills are on auto pay. I'm like, well, what's this? She's like, it's junk mail and one-off bills. So I'm like, all right. So she goes and she keeps opening and whatever. And I say, I'm going to go to bed. She's like, I'm going to go to bed too. And she takes a stack about this big and shoves it back in the drawer. I'm like, whoa, Marth, what's that? She's like, well, those are the bills that need to be paid. I'm like, and you're not going to pay them? She's like, I've done enough work tonight. That is what is happening to most people's bills.
Yeah.
Unless you are the electric company, the water company, the mortgage, the car payment, unless you are that really steady, going to pay that same amount every month forever that could go on auto pay.
Right.
Martha is shoving your bill after waiting 6 weeks to open it. She's shoving it back in a drawer to be paid. God only knows when.
Right.
Always take payment timing out of the client's hands. You always need to be in control. You always need to have their credit card, and you always need to be authorized to charge it at the appropriate time.
Love it. Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100%. Like, I have mine just for full disclosure. I don't start work until I receive payment. And it goes, mm-hmm. I use trust. I use my trust account for that. And my agreement specifically states that I'm not obligated, and attorneys have different, you know, weird rules that we have to abide by, as you know, right. but I don't, I'm not their attorney until they pay, until they sign the agreement and until they pay. And yeah. I also don't take payment plans, right? Like, and some people do, and I'm not going to judge them for that. Personally, I found that I end up getting screwed or stiffed on the back end of it if I take a payment plan. And so, and people have repeated to me and said, and I agree with this, I'm not a bank, right? Like, if you need to get money for attorney services, I understand. I'm not cheap. I understand that. I'm not suggesting I am. But if you need help with that, a couple of things. Number one, There's things called banks and credit cards, and I take all of those. And number two, if your family won't loan you money in the case, if you need legal services, why should I? And I'm not trying to say, I'm not trying to be the heartless. I have a heart. Absolutely, I have a heart. But if I can't pay my expenses and I can't pay my stuff and I can't support my family, well, that's on me. That's not on you, right? As my client, my job is to do your legal work, not worry about how I get paid, right? Because that adds to the difficulty of it. And I think a lot of people forget about that, right? They forget about the people that they're, you pay me means I can pay others, right? And means that I can help others. If you don't pay me, then I go out of business, and then what? Then you're going to be stuck with companies that charge absurd amounts of money for the same thing. I had a client come to me, and they showed me their contract that they'd had a major law firm, I won't name names, in San Diego here, that had charged them $7,000 for this contract. And I looked at the contract, and it wasn't a bad contract. It was a decent contract. And I'm not saying mine would be better, but it was not a $7,000 contract, right? But that's what they charged. Now, I don't know what their actual collection was on it. You know, there's always that factor. They might have said seven, and then they ended up taking five or four or whatever the heck for it. But I looked at that and I went, you know, I'm trying to serve a community because I only do flat rate. That's one thing that I absolutely don't. I hate the billable hour. I don't believe in it. I think it's a waste. I think it encourages waste, I should say, for attorneys to spend as much humanly time on something as possible, and then to mark it down because the client gets upset about it because it's an absurd bill, rather than just upfront pricing to begin with, right? And then it changes the risk level, right? Like the risk is taken, it's more evenly distributed because I know how long things are going to take better in law than the client does. I've gotten some of my biggest clients, my best clients, because of my flat fees, because they say, oh, I'm a predictable expense, as opposed to if I hire another attorney, we could be talking two and three times that. And so it encourages efficiency. And that's one of the reasons why I do flat fees only. But I only get paid up front, and I don't take card for that reason. Or I don't take checks, actually. That's the other thing, because I've had them bounce on me. But I digress. I think that's such a valid point, like about getting paid, right? Like paying and being paid and following up and with systems. Oh, I love systems. Systems are like my jam when it comes to stuff. What are some systems that you've put in place or that you've helped small businesses put in place that have gotten them paid, that have helped their AR?
Well, I think that it comes down to the contract. Like I said, AR is created the first time you meet a client.
Right.
So what kind of contract do you have? If you're a retail store, you have an implied contract of you pay me and I hand you the merchandise, right?
Right.
That's pretty easy.
Right.
If you're a service-based business, it's a little harder, right? Because you do the service and you're like, gonna get paid. So in that case, I think you're right. I like to get a certain amount upfront. I usually like enough to cover the first 3 months of work and then keep 3 months ahead. And the reason I do 3 months is because you're gonna work on the project, whatever it is, whether you're an attorney or a marketing agency or whatever it is, you're going to work on it for the first month. You're going to bill it out on day one of month two. I don't care what you tell your client. The client thinks they have 30 days to pay. I mean, your bill could say due upon receipt. It could say due in 5 days, due in 10 days. The client doesn't care. They shoved it in the drawer, Martha, and they think they have 30 days to pay. So that's all the way through month two. So now at the beginning of month three, you're just starting to try to collect that money.
Right.
And the client just now thinks that the money's actually due.
Right.
So it takes about 3 months. Gotcha. And then you stay that 3 months ahead. You always make sure that you are billing enough to stay that 3 months ahead. And people are always like, well, you know, Brooke, they proved that they would pay me.
Right.
But here's the thing, a client will stop paying at any time for any reason, and it rarely has anything to do with you.
Right.
It has to do with the fact that they have a tuition bill for their college age child, right?
Yeah.
That's much more important than you. I don't care what you do.
Right.
That's more important than you. So you always want to keep that 3 month ahead. Like I said, take payment timing out of the client's hand. And have some kind of clause in your agreement that says if they don't pay, not only are you not going to provide service, but if they don't pay, they have, by not paying you, by the conscious decision to not pay you, they have terminated your services.
Right.
And that's a huge difference.
Right.
Because then they haven't paid you and they have fired you. You're like, it's not like I quit providing services. You fired me.
Right.
You quit paying.
Yeah.
Agreement says you don't pay for 3 months. I have been fired.
Yeah. And then one of the things that I like to address in my contracts is what happens with the money that may not have been right. Like as far as like collections go. If, for instance, it's always easier for you to return money if for something that's not earned than it is to try to get money from somebody, right? Like that's one of the big things I've seen is that people are like, well, I'll get things later. I'll get this, you know, as I go. And the problem is that if you do that, then you're risking, like you said, they'll stop paying. And then how do you, you know, do you keep working
always.
For free, right? Like, no.
Always stay 3 months ahead.
Yeah. I like that. I like that. That's good.
Stay 3 months ahead. And, you know, I've seen all kinds of people treat AR different ways. I've seen people that think of it like the ones that really crack me up are the ones that are like, no, I don't actually want to collect that yet because if I collect it, I'm going to have to pay taxes on it. Okay. Once again, people.
Taxes aren't bad.
60% of something is much better than 100% of nothing.
Right.
The other ones, I've had clients that have been like, they pretty much treated AR like a piggy bank.
Right.
Like I'm putting all that AR in there and then someday when I need it, I'm going to call and they're going to magically pay me. No, they're not going to magically pay you.
Oh,
and after 90 days, they really aren't going to want to pay you at all.
Right.
So yeah, give up on that.
Yeah, and then that's 100%. Like, I couldn't imagine using AR as my piggy bank, and to think that they'll pay. The longer the distance between when they pay or when you do their service to when they pay, the less likely they will pay it. Like, there's a reason why AR is, you know, they can go 180 days and whatnot, because if they don't think that they have to pay you, then they're not going to, right? Yeah. Like, and you reminding them is just going to piss them off. It isn't going to get them to pay you. That's the thing about it. And then it just snowballs from there.
I say that AR is like rotting fruit. Mm. Every day that goes by, it is less valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the time value of money right there, right? Money today is worth more than money tomorrow. Right. And that's one of the reasons why I don't do payment plans is because I don't want to risk that. Right. Like, I don't want to have to deal with that issue. Okay. You've been incredibly, I've thoroughly enjoyed having you on here and talking, especially finance with, because this is a big issue, right? This is something that a lot of entrepreneurs, they get into and they don't sit down and they don't start looking at their numbers. Like, what is their, you know, COGS, right? What is their profit margin? If you ask most of them, they're not even going to have a ballpark answer.
Right.
And that can be a real problem because you don't even know if you're profitable or not. And if you're not profitable, what are you doing, right? Like, I had an entrepreneur that she wanted to do social media marketing. And I'm like, great, I'm happy to help you. I set up LLCs and help businesses with their legal stuff all the time. And then I started looking at the terms that she wanted. And I said, you know, you pick your terms. And she's like, oh, $25 an hour. And I was like, you do realize that you won't go anywhere with this, right? I'm like, I sat down and I said, you're basically an employee at that rate. And what about all of your other expenses? What about your overhead? What about all of this? And she's like, no, that's what I want. And surprisingly, or not surprisingly, is whichever way we want to go with it, she ended up out of business because she didn't account for those things. She didn't charge enough and people treated her that way, right? Like, because she was essentially just a glorified employee at that point. And so if you treat it like you're an employee, then that's what's going to end up happening. You're going to be an employee.
It's gonna happen.
Yeah. And so that was, you know, pricing is an important part. If you're not profitable, what are you doing? So anyway, it has been so good talking with you. Thank you so much. I've been throughout this sharing on the screen, but for our listeners that are audio only, where can people find you?
I think the easiest place to find us is on our website. Okay. It's cathcap.com, CathCap.com. But, you know, like every company these days, we're on LinkedIn, mm-hmm. we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram. Got to tell you on that one, I'm like, really? What are you going to do? Put like pictures of spreadsheets up there? But they found fun things on Instagram. That's so,
Ooh, I forgot.
Cathedral Capital.
I have some fun questions. I forgot the questions.
Let's see.
Yeah. The what's your worst roommate or house guest story?
Oh, all right. So I had a friend, and this has actually happened to me twice. So that might say more about me than them. But the second time it happened, I had a friend, she was going to do about 6 weeks worth of work in her house. And it was an insurance claim. She's like, my insurance company will pay you rent. I'm like, okay, that would be awesome.
Right.
So she moves in. I'm like, insurance company going to pay me? Insurance company going to pay me? 1 month, 2 months, 3 months? Fine. She's like, no, it's too much of a pain for me to file and tell them to pay you. She lived with me for 6 months. Did not pay a bill.
Oh my God.
Did not offer to pay for anything. Did not put groceries in the fridge. Nothing. I kept cutting services, trying to get her to leave. Like, I got rid of the housekeeper. She stayed. I'm like, okay. I started turning the temperature in the house up in the summer.
Oh my God.
She still wouldn't leave. So,
oh my, yeah. Oh my, yeah.
I mean, I literally tried to sweat her out of my house.
That's interesting. That's funny. I mean, wow. I couldn't imagine doing that. Like I've had crazy roommates in the past. So I had one that he would check his mail with white gloves. I don't know why.
Nice.
He just, and he was the same that I had my uncle in my room. This was many, many years ago. And I had my uncle who I hadn't seen in 5 or 6 years, something crazy. And we were in my room just talking quietly. It wasn't like I had a party or anything going on. And the next day he had a talk with me about how I shouldn't have guests over at, you know, 9 o'clock at night. And I didn't last there long because I was like, are you flipping kidding me? So. I'm a grown adult. I'm a 20-something responsible human being. I wasn't, you know, it wasn't a party. I wasn't hurting anybody. It was me and my uncle talking quietly in my room. And it was just nuts. So I moved out of there as fast as I humanly possibly could. The things that you don't know about somebody until you get into that type of relationship with them is crazy. So thank you again so much for coming on. I sincerely appreciate it. I know that my listeners will appreciate it as well. And I look forward to sending this out to them. And I hope you have a great day. So wasn't that great? Brooke was absolutely amazing and so helpful. And I hope that you will listen and take into account that the things that you can do to help push your business forward and knowing your numbers is so very important. Please keep that in mind. Start tracking your numbers. That's the very base thing. QuickBooks Online is not that expensive. There are other software services, Soho, so on and so forth. Please look at that. And until next time, make sure you're thinking about your business tactically.